You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Thanks to everybody who donated during our winter member drive. All the programs you enjoy are possible because people like you generously support it. If you missed the drive, join tens of thousands of dedicated WPR members with your gift right now at WPR.org. And thank you. Now, North Korea hasn't been front and center in U.S. foreign policy news lately after the expanded Russian invasion of Ukraine and tensions with China. But North Korean leadership is making a bid to change that. Over the last few weeks, the country has launched a series of missile tests, including short-range missiles that could threaten South Korea and Japan, and a longer-range missile that analysts say could potentially reach the United States. And North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un has issued nuclear threats in response to planned military training exercises in South Korea, including U.S. and South Korean troops. Our next guest is a Wisconsin expert on U.S. relations with North and South Korea, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the latest news and the long-running tensions between the U.S. and North Korea? What would you want to see from U.S. leadership in the region? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. David Fields, Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison. He's the author of Foreign Friends, Syngman Rhee, American Exceptionalism, and the Division of Korea. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me back, Rob. I really enjoy it.
Let's talk about these new missile tests. As I mentioned, one long range, some shorter range ones. What do you make of the tests and the timing?
Yeah, so I think there's primarily two reasons why North Korea tests missiles. The first is to advance their own missile technology to make sure that if at some point in the future they want to deliver a nuclear warhead somewhere, that they will actually be able to do it and that missile will function. And then they also test them as a sort of messaging, usually a way to send a signal to the United States or the ROK or perhaps the UN Security Council that they are unhappy with something that has just happened. And the tests that we saw last weekend, and actually my phone just pinged about a few minutes ago, and there was another test probably within the last hour. These are clearly a bit of both. And we know that because the North Korean Foreign Ministry spokesman, as well as Kim Yo-jung, Kim Jong-un's younger sister, said so quite explicitly late last week. And they said that these tests are in response to the announced US-ROK joint military exercises and tabletop drills. The tabletop exercise happened in the Pentagon this last Wednesday, and the joint military exercises will happen in March. So this is clearly a response to that, but I think it's also clearly a signal that they are determined to continue developing their missile technology. So just for some context, since 1984, North Korea has tested or conducted 229 missile tests. 69 of those happened in 2022. So fully 30% of their missile tests happened within the last year, and they're testing various types of missiles. They're testing various types of engines for those missiles. And it seems pretty clear that this testing is designed to make sure that they have a credible delivery system for their nuclear weapons, should they ever choose to use them. They're not putting all their eggs in one particular type of missile technology. And it requires a lot of testing to make sure they have a viable system.
Now, those U.S. Republic of Korea, what we often call South Korea, those military exercises. Now, these kind of military exercises, I assume, have gone on for decades with U.S. troops and South Korean troops training for potential North Korean invasion. Is there anything particularly different about this one coming up in the spring?
No, there isn't. And this is such an interesting topic. And you're right, they have gone on for decades, but they change constantly. Some of them are very, very large scale, you know, involving thousands of forces from both sides using live fire. And some of them are actually, like I referred to, the ones that happened at the Pentagon on Wednesday, are tabletop exercises. So they involve a very small number of, you know, high ranking US ROK officials and basically go through different scenarios. And how do we respond? How do we game out what we do in these situations? And they involve no troop movements at all. And I find this topic so interesting. And if your listeners find it interesting, I encourage you to check out a podcast on the nknews.org podcast with a retired Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Tharp, who was involved in these trainings for years. And he goes through the different kinds of trainings that have been done, the different iterations from the very large to the very small. But one point I want to highlight about these exercises is North Korea claims that these are very threatening to their security. And to a certain extent, that's understandable. But at the same time, these tests are announced. They're announced weeks in advance. The North Koreans know that they're going to happen. Most of them do not happen anywhere near the DMZ. And this is done very much out in the open. And that is in great contrast to North Korean missile tests, which often the first news of a missile test comes after the missile has been fired and its launch has been detected through various assets in South Korea and Japan and the United States. So there's a lot more risk involved to testing a missile about whether it's an whether it's real or whether it's an actual test than there is to these joint military exercises.
And David, I've often thought of North Korean nuclear technology in part as a defensive action, another thing to say, okay, here's a great reason not to attempt to invade North Korea. But I've seen some arguments that they could view these as an offensive capability, a first move if North Korea were to invade South Korea. What do you have concerns along those lines?
Yes, I think this is very important for listeners to understand that these, in my mind, these weapons have three different purposes. Okay, the first one is a defensive purpose. It makes it less likely that any country is going to invade North Korea when they have nuclear weapons. But I should be clear, that's not the only deterrent they have. Almost the entire city of Seoul is within artillery range and rocket-assisted artillery range of the DMZ. So they hold the city of Seoul hostage whether or not they have nuclear weapons. But it does serve a defensive purpose. It also could serve an offensive purpose if they would ever be interested in trying to reunify the Korean Peninsula, which, by the way, has been a consistent part of their propaganda since really 1948 and the creation of the DPRK. I happen to think that they are not too serious about that in the short term because they know that they would most likely be defeated easily by joint U.S. ROK forces if they attempted to do that. But I don't think the regime has ever disavowed that as a long-term goal. And if something would happen to split up the U.S. ROK alliance, I think many North Koreans would see that as a very positive development that could possibly make a unification by force more likely. And nuclear weapons would be very useful in that regard, especially as blackmail to encourage other countries to stay out of such a future conflict. And then finally, North Korean nuclear weapons are a tangible success story that the Kim regime can tell its people. Any North Koreans who were born, you know, prior to 1980, you cannot tell those people that they live better lives today than they did then because of the visionary leadership of Kim Jong-il or Kim Jong-un, because they don't. Their lives are materially poorer and more difficult in every single way. But what the Kim regime can say is we have developed these incredibly powerful weapons that make us a true player on the world stage and is the ultimate guarantee of the existence of our state and really of us as a race. And this is something that is incredibly valuable to the regime. I mean, they put these weapons on their postage stamps constantly. It's something that they can crow about. And I think it's an equal reason as to why they're developing. And in my mind, too, it's also a reason why they are unlikely to trade them away. What can the United States or the international community offer them that will be as valuable as nuclear weapons? We can offer them things that are perhaps as valuable as a deterrent, perhaps. But what can we offer them that meets these other two needs for the nuclear weapons?
One thing that has come from the outside world at points in history is food. North Korea had a major multi-year famine in the 1990s. I'm seeing reports that food insecurity is at the highest level there since then. And it just baffles me, David, at a fundamental level. A country that is unsuccessful at basic things like feeding its own citizenry, and yet having this highly advanced, very expensive missile and nuclear weapon technology, my brain can't square that. How does it work?
Well, it's a choice. You know, it's unfortunately a choice that the regime has made. They could provide for their people. In fact, it wouldn't really take much more money. It would just take a little bit of liberalization in their economy, a little bit of liberalization in the kind of restrictions on movements and goods and people that exist in North Korea today. I mean, just opening up that now there are black markets everywhere in North Korea that operate kind of maybe more in a gray zone than a black zone. But even just making those markets legitimate would maybe address a lot of their food shortage issues. But, you know, North Korea is, you know, like anywhere else, they have droughts, they have floods, they have these natural disasters, but they're already, North Koreans are already living such a perilous existence that where another country could turn to the open market, you know, could turn to other places to get food, North Korea does not do this. And I think the reports that we're seeing just highlight the ongoing tragedy in North Korea, where 20 million North Koreans live in really dire circumstances, are food insecure and live in poverty. And it's very sad because it doesn't have to be that way. It is a choice. They could fix this. They have chosen to invest in other things. And the Kim regime has chosen to invest in a strategy to maintain its leadership that actually compels underdevelopment throughout North Korea. I firmly believe this is one of the ways that the regime maintains itself in power. It keeps the majority of the population too poor, too isolated, and too dedicated to their own search for subsistence to really have any desire or effort to begin to plan or think about alternatives to the Kim regime. It's really the divide and conquer strategy.
David Fields is with us from the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison, looking at the latest North Korean missile tests and U.S. relations with North and South Korea. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about North Korea, the Republic of Korea, U.S. relations with those countries, and the latest news? Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with David Fields from the UW-Madison Center for East Asian Studies, looking at the U.S.-North Korea relationship after the latest threats and missile launches from North Korea. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Let's bring on a caller. Steve is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Steve.
Yes, hi. With all due respect, we're already in World War III with Russia, China, North Korea, Iran. You know, when the United States, when Biden administration ordered the blowing up of the Russia's oil pipeline into Germany, that was an act of war in violation of international law.
Okay, I'll stop you there, Steve. That is, there was that pipeline that blew up. Russia and some others have claimed that the United States was behind it. There are investigations. We don't know who blew it up at this point, David. Steve's point, he thinks we're in a higher state of war with, or of tension anyway, with North Korea, Russia, and China. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, and I don't want to speak to the specifics of what the caller is saying, but I think these are times of heightened tensions. And I think when you look at the direction that global politics is going right now, there's a lot of reason to be somewhat concerned. And I think that's also a key part of the context in which North Korea is testing so many missiles. This is a very favorable international situation for them. The war in Ukraine is bringing Russia and China closer together, and it's pushing both of those countries further from the United States. And what that means for North Korea is they can engage in additional testing, and they're unlikely to suffer greater consequences for it because Russia and China is going to oppose greater sanctions in the UN Security Council. And they are very lax on imposing the sanctions that have already existed. So I think it's not a coincidence that they have been testing so many missiles in the last calendar year. Also, since May and June of last year, American intelligence, as well as South Korean intelligence, has been saying that a seventh North Korean nuclear test is imminent. It has not happened yet, but all the preparations have been made. And it's likely that it will probably happen sometime in the near future. And this is the perfect time to conduct that kind of test when the old coalition of the six party states that surround North Korea, including Russia and China, who used to cooperate on trying to rein in North Korean behavior, are not so interested in doing that anymore.
Speaking of Russia, there's some intelligence that North Korea has been supplying Russia, trading more with Russia since that invasion, including potentially ammunition for the Russian occupation of parts of Ukraine. Have you seen anything along those lines?
Yes, and there are reports coming from U.S. intelligence saying that, you know, ammunition, specifically artillery shells, is being transshipped from North Korea into Russia via third parties in the Middle East and Africa. We don't exactly know. They're not revealing how they know this. The North Koreans, for their part, are denying it, so it's not confirmed. But it would fit perfectly in line with North Korea's past behaviors. The North Korean regime, because of sanctions they're under, has a very difficult time getting hard currency. And so they are very creative at finding ways to finance themselves, including selling illicitly whatever they can find a buyer for, as well as engaging in insurance fraud, cyber theft, hacking, creating monumental statues in certain African republics. They're a very entrepreneurial nation. So while this isn't confirmed, it would not be surprising to me at all to know that this is the case. North Korea has a surplus of artillery shells that they don't have a particular immediate use for, and Russia has a use for those things. So it's not surprising at all if that would be the case.
Talking to David Fields from the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison, looking at the latest from North Korea. David, people have been paying a lot of attention to the succession who would take over in North Korea after Kim Jong-un. A lot of photos, a lot of public appearances with one of his daughters, whose name I understand we don't actually know. We have hints from Dennis Rodman. It's weird. You are skeptical, though, that we should read too much into this, I understand.
I am. And the name that gets kicked around is Kim Ju-ae, and that may well be her name. But our sole source for that is Dennis Rodman all the way back in 2013. So again, it's one of those things that could be true, but is unverified. And yeah, her public appearance for the first time in November and then a series of appearances just this month has led to a lot of speculation that, Kim Jong-un's health has taken a turn for the worse, that this is an anointing of his chosen successor. All of that could be possible, but it is all speculation. Just why the North Koreans are doing this right now, there's a lot of theories. That's one of them. Another theory, and this is the one that I like a lot better, is Kim Jong-un is trying to bolster his image as a family man and bolster an image of him as a loving and caring parent. And if you look at what we could call the iconography of North Korean leaders, going from Kim Il-sung to Kim Jong-il, if you look at that, you'll realize that they do not present a hyper-masculine warrior king image to the world. Very different from, say, the image of Vladimir Putin, dipping shirtless in an icy lake. That has never been the Kim style. They like to portray themselves in a much more fatherly way, often surrounded by children. And the idea is that they are the fatherly, loving leader of the entire nation. This has been part of their brand from the beginning. And, nothing makes that easier for Kim Jong-un than appearing with his daughter, with his young daughter, whenever he feels the need to do so. I think it's a way to humanize him. And there are other theories out there as well, that maybe he just wants to raise his children differently than his father raised him. He was raised entirely outside the public eye. He wants to have a more normal family life in public. There's also the interesting idea that South Korean intelligence believes that he has other children, possibly a son, and that this son may be being educated in Europe quietly right now, the way he was educated. And so all the media attention on his daughter is maybe deflecting some interest in his other children. All of this is pure speculation, but I'm a big fan of Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is probably the best. And so the idea that this is a part of a media campaign to really bolster his image as a fatherly leader makes sense to me.
And you, David, are working on a book on Trump administration policy toward North Korea. The former president weighed in on his social media site. I'm going to quote here, Kim Jong-un of North Korea, who I got to know and got along with very well during my years as president, is not happy with the U.S. and South Korea doing big training and air exercises together. Trump goes on, he feels threatened, and then complained that South Korea doesn't pay the U.S. enough to do these military training drills. What do you make of that as you're thinking a lot, I assume, about the Trump administration and North Korea?
Well, this has been something that Donald Trump has been saying about specifically South Korea for a very long time, that these training exercises are too expensive. He was clearly interested in trying to monetize the alliance when he was there, demanding that South Korea not only pay the costs of what it costs to put U.S. soldiers there, but pay beyond the cost. He was looking to make a profit out of the alliance. And I think it's pretty clear that he still thinks the same way today. And if he's reelected as president, he will probably pursue those policies again. I think it's quite possible that Kim Jong-un feels threatened by these military exercises. But as I said at the beginning of the broadcast, the United States and the ROK go out of their way to try to make these exercises as least threatening as possible. But, the fact is that North Korea undertakes military exercises, missile tests all the time without any sort of warning. That is very threatening to its neighbors. And if, God forbid, something would happen on the Korean Peninsula, it's important that U.S. and ROK soldiers have these experiences of actually training together so they can operate effectively to meet any of those threats.
Briefly, as we wrap up, David, a lot of American presidents have tried a lot of different things when it comes to relations with North Korea. It seems to me sometimes that there's just not necessarily a right answer. Do you see any prospects for any kind of improvement?
Sadly, Rob, I don't. I think the best solution is try to keep your allies on sides, maintain a strong coalition for confronting North Korean behavior, try to keep the cost for that behavior as high as possible, even though you know you cannot fundamentally stop them from doing what you want to do, and hope that you can prevent some sort of catastrophic conflict until some passage of time will make a solution possible. But in many ways, what Donald Trump did was radical, outside of the box thinking. If it would have worked, he deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. It didn't work. I think Joe Biden is returning to the conventional strategy. And I think there's not a lot of other opportunities out there.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's David Fields, Associate Director of the Center for East Asian Studies at UW-Madison and author of Foreign Friends, Syngman Rhee, American Exceptionalism and the Division of Korea. He joined us for a look at the latest news from North Korea. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's a one-year anniversary of the expanded Russian invasion of Ukraine. We'll look at the impact of the Russian attack and Ukrainian resistance and what could come next. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're going to learn to cook Indian food with ingredients available in local stores. We'll talk to the author of the book, Six Spices, 60 Recipes. A couple of my favorite spices in there, too, and a couple that would broaden my cooking palate. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, newly released documents from a lawsuit filed against Fox News show that some of their personalities and executives may have knowingly promoted misinformation about the 2020 presidential election. We'll get the details. First, we recently received a question from Patricia Meyer from Beaver Dam as part of our Why Wisconsin project. She asked, I am curious about the history of railroads in Wisconsin, especially the early stages of rail transportation in the state. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of trains in Wisconsin? What do you find interesting about trains, railroads, their history? Do you go to railroad museums, say? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Lidke is the curator at the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
When do we start to see the first railroads coming to Wisconsin?
Well, we started to see those actually into the 1850s. The year before Wisconsin became a state, the Milwaukee and Waukesha Railroad was chartered in 1847, but they didn't fully complete anything until 1851. And actually in that time, they changed their name. It became the Milwaukee and Mississippi Railroad in 1850. And then on February 25th of 1851, we have our first train ride going from Milwaukee to Waukesha, and that was the first passenger train here in the state.
Yeah, when it comes to the early first couple decades of rail, was it more that kind of thing, passengers, or more freight, say agricultural products moving around and out of Wisconsin?
Yeah, it really was a combination of both. What was interesting, the railroad itself, that first one, Milwaukee and Mississippi, they started in February with that first passenger train, and already by April, they were hauling freight too. They had one passenger and one freight train that would run each day. And then right after that, you started having more railroads coming in. So the Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific, or what we typically called the Milwaukee Road, they came up and were forming in the 1850s. The Milwaukee and Mississippi really was kind of the precursor to that railroad. The Chicago Northwestern was coming up from Chicago in the 1850s also. And then you had some other Green Bay and Western in the 1870s, Northern Pacific later on. And really, the big thing was to meet the needs of transporting agricultural goods to the east. So a lot of the wheat, getting that moved to the east. And then really with the passenger side of things, that opened up the state really for Yankee settlers to come in. You know, before that, what you're really looking at with the territory and early statehood, you're looking at the waterways for your transportation. So this was a great way to transport yourself, really, if you're coming into the area for entrepreneurial things or just relocating, and also moved in with immigrants. So it really opened up immigration to the state.
We're going to call her at 800-642-1234. Lou is with us in Ashland. Lou, hi.
Hey, good snowy day to everybody. yeah, I'm a transport driver, and some of my passengers have said that the roads that intersect main roads, like, say, 13, the ones that are kind of at an angle that don't intersect and have sharp corners, and, you know, they'll come in kind of at an angle and then continue on the other side at an angle. And they often say that they are old railroad tracks. And I'm just wondering if, you know, if there's any validity to that.
Oh, interesting. I had never heard that, Daniel. Do you know anything about that?
You know, and some of them may very well be. It's kind of interesting, especially when you're looking at early, you know, early towns being developed in our area here in Green Bay. You had the French coming in first, then the British, then the Americans. So they all set up their cities differently. So some were making their plot lines, you know, connecting to the rivers, and some were making more of a grid system. So even here, our streets, all of a sudden you might be driving north-south one way and there's a bizarre angle because it was an old path, an old street. A lot of the railroads, too, they had to kind of navigate some of those areas by rivers, by other geographic features. So they would try and get, you know, as direct of route as possible, or the easiest route for laying the tracks. So some of those might be. I know, too, when you're looking at some of those rails to trails things, too, along the cities, those were all the old rail lines. So that they follow those, too.
Thanks for the call, Lou, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Lidke from the National Railroad Museum in Green Bay, talking about Wisconsin's early railroad history, answering a Wisconsin question. We got another question from the UW-Madison Science Outreach Department on Twitter. They asked, I don't know if they're trying to stump us here, they asked, how did the railroad built in 1857 from Madison through what is today's UW-Madison campus and on to Prairie du Chien lead to the naming of the Camp Randall Stadium? I wonder if they know the answer and they're not letting on. I don't know. Daniel, do you know anything about that part of the railroad history?
Well, and that's a great question, too. The Camp Randall itself, and I will immediately apologize to most of the callers here, most of the listeners. I am not big into sports, but I am into history. So the Camp Randall itself that I know more of the history of was the Camp Randall that was formed in 1861 to meet the needs of having a place for new recruits to go and get trained for the Civil War. So Camp Randall was actually named after Governor Randall of the state when he really, when Abraham Lincoln was pushing to get places to get recruits. So the Milwaukee, at that point, it was a Milwaukee and Mississippi Railroad. They did have a line coming into Wisconsin, or into Madison rather. So that was probably the way they were getting troops, new recruits in and out of there. The stadium then, I apologize, I want to say it was early 1900s, 1917. So they still had that rail line, the Milwaukee Road still had a rail line going through to Madison. And they ran trains going into Madison. They actually had into the 40s and 50s, there was a specific train that was going from Chicago to Madison. The Varsity, and that was bringing a lot of people to the games, especially on the weekends or holiday service to the games. So Camp Randall itself was named after the governor for the Civil War stuff, and then the stadium was named after the Civil War recruitment camp itself.
Excellent. Okay. And we also had a Wisconsin question in the past. You can find it at WPR.org on the role of Camp Randall in the Civil War. So you can find a little more about that. Can you talk some about, especially in the 1800s, you were starting to touch on this, how much trains changed our lives, our daily lives, our personal lives, where we chose to live if we were Wisconsinites in the second half of the 1800s?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, with anything, when the railroads came through, regardless of what state it was, but specifically here in Wisconsin, when you're looking at the early railroads, with the first railroad, you know, got our first ride in 1851, you had about between 20 to 40 miles. And already by 1880, you've jumped from that 20-mile mark to having over 3,000 miles of rail in the state. So all the railroads coming through, and investors in the railroads, entrepreneurs, you know, seeing the value of this new source of transportation, you know, and that continued well into the 1920s, really was the height of the industry. And then we see a decline. But you're bringing people in, not only for work, for, you know, building their new lives, for coming into the state. And then you're kind of getting into this, you know, what we think of more today with using the railroad for more leisure activities. So you've gone for it really being primarily the industry for moving, moving goods or moving people, to starting to get it as more of transportation, vacations. Going back to the Camp Randall thing, sports trains, you had teams, sports teams riding on these trains. You had it bringing people to up to Green Bay for games, to Madison. So it really changes. Even hunting, there would be hunting excursions on these trains on the weekend going up to Loretta, up in Ashland County, Star Lake, Wisconsin. So you've got specific trains, Fisherman's Special in the Northwoods, Hiawatha, bringing people up to go hunting and fishing. So it really changed not only bringing people into the state, but how we moved around within the state.
In just our last minute or so, Daniel, can you share one of your favorite or most recent exhibits at the Railroad Museum? I've enjoyed visits there, and my kids certainly did a lot too.
Yeah, this is actually perfect because we have an exhibit right now called Rail Ties, and it's focusing on community stories. So it's really looking at people who either worked for the railroad or had families working for the railroad or had experiences that might be interested in telling us their story, to give oral histories here at the museum, or to, you know, if they want to loan an item and they have a neat story, whether it's a picture or an object, because we really want to preserve that history, both with the oral histories and the objects themselves. But we also want people to realize, you know, trains aren't just those things that you get stuck at by the crossing when you're watching all these freight cars go by. It had a huge impact and continues to have a huge impact on the state. So, yeah, our newest exhibit, Rail Ties, really is trying to get that community engagement and involvement here with the museum, both now and continued.
And briefly, Daniel, if somebody says, yeah, I have a story or an artifact to share, are you still looking for those?
Yeah, absolutely. We started the exhibit at the beginning of the month here, but I'm going to be rotating things out throughout the year. And again, we always want those oral histories too. So any of those items, so they're welcome to contact me here at the museum.
Daniel, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's Daniel Lidke, curator at the National Railroad Museum based in Green Bay. He joined us to help answer a listener question for the Why Wisconsin Project about the history of trains in the state. We're done riding the rails, but come up, we'll hike and bike on them with a look at rails to trails projects here in the state and beyond. That's next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We just learned about the history of trains in Wisconsin's early years. Staying on track, we're going to answer two more Wisconsin questions related to trains and railroads. Some railroad lines aren't railroads at all anymore, but we can still use them to get around. For some of those abandoned or otherwise removed railroads, they might get turned into a trail system. Typically referred to as a rail trail or rails to trails, these old railroads now offer a place for people to hike or bike. We recently received a couple of questions from John Hansen and Phil Kasnowski from Medford and from Madison. They asked, why was the first rail to trail in the nation developed in Wisconsin's Elroy, Sparta area? History, people, groups to thank, how can it be expanded? And also about the history of the rails to trails and or other trails in the state. Earlier today, I got some answers to those questions with Eric Oberg, Midwest Regional Director of the Rails to Trails Conservancy. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, Wisconsin, pretty prominent figure in the rail to trail movement. We've got the first one, as I understand it, the Elroy Sparta Trail. How big a deal was this when this first rail in the country, first rail to trail in the country got started?
Yeah, it was huge, right? The rail trail movement really started just a bit south of you guys in the Chicago suburbs. And there was a school teacher, Mary Teelgard Watts, in the 60s that wrote a letter to the editor posing the proposition that the railroad track in her community be turned into a place for people to get out and walk and have a place to go. And that really kickstarted it. Elroy Sparta became the first developed rail trail. So, you know, it was really just a really good idea that happened to meet a perfect time. But it was a slow burn at the very beginning. It's not like it exploded right off the bat, but humble beginnings and in the Midwest, in Wisconsin, in Illinois.
And one of our Wisconsin question askers was curious about why that Elroy Sparta Trail, in fact, was converted into a trail. Was there something about that stretch that made it an attractive first developed trail?
Well, it's interesting, right? I mean, I'll start by saying that this movement started really slowly, you know, Elroy Sparta being the first one. And it took almost 20 years for Rail Trail Conservancy to be founded in 1986. And at that point, there was still only 250 miles of rail trail, which may sound like a lot, but today we have over 25,000 miles of rail trail. So what Elroy Sparta did was essentially prove the concept, right? And it was not the easiest thing. If any of your listeners that have been out there, it's the reason it's so wonderful. The tunnels are just unbelievable. But of course, tunnels and bridges are also big, expensive, and complicated pieces of infrastructure. So if you were to think about trying to create the first rail trail, while Elroy Sparta is undoubtedly one of the coolest and most beautiful, and those bridges and tunnels are awesome, they're also really difficult. So it wasn't the easiest, but it maybe it was the best, because it gave people that, you know, when you went out, the people that finally got to go out and see what a rail trail was like, if they went to Elroy Sparta, they were blown away, right? It's really cool. So it wasn't the easiest, but in hindsight, maybe it was the best.
Now, if you've ever tried to walk on a railroad track, it is not pleasant. Biking, less so, I imagine. What does it take? Can you talk about just the efforts to take a length of track, forget the tunnel and bridge for now, and turn it into a trail?
Well, you know, I'm not going to say it's easy, but I will say these corridors were engineered by, you know, the best and the brightest of their day, right? But these railroads really were the cutting edge of transportation when they were designed and engineered and built. So when you think about what they were built to do, to carry tons and tons of train and car, you know, of railroads and cargo, they make the perfect base for a walking and biking trail. And so you have a lot of the elements that you would need for a trail already in place, a wonderful substrate, you know, that all of that heavy rock and everything that they needed for a train is perfect for, it's over-engineered for a walking and biking trail. So it's just and maybe the most key thing about it, they also went from somewhere to somewhere, right? The railroads weren't building trails because they weren't building rail corridors because it was beautiful country and they just wanted to see neat things from the, you know, from the front of the train. The engineer didn't, they needed to get things from a place to a place. And that's the beauty of rail trails now. They certainly go through beautiful country, obviously, but they also connect people and communities because that's what the railroads did.
One of our Wisconsin listeners mentioned that within months of moving to Wisconsin, he felt like his local rail trail out of Medford encouraged him to explore his new city and go bike riding. Can you talk about the benefits and how this gets people in many communities outside?
Yeah, I love it. And one of my favorite, one of my favorite sentiments about rail trails was something that one of our founders at Rails to Trails Conservancy said, David Burwell. His dream was that rail trails would become America's main street. And that bit of nostalgia about what Main Street used to be, where, you know, families and people would be walking down Main Street and saying hi to each other. And it really was the place where community happened, right? And we've kind of driven, designed and suburbanized ourselves out of that Main Street community. And trails really have become, trails that go through around communities have become a place where community happens. And so that listener saying he gets on his bike and you know, really enjoys the community he's in, it's because that's where the community is. You're seeing young people, kids, families, old people. You're seeing folks walking, biking, mobility impaired with a wheelchair or otherwise. I mean, every facet of your community is out using that trail. And unlike in your car when you pass people, if you pass people on a trail, it is a personal experience. At the very least, you smile at each other. More often than not, you say hello. Maybe you stop to have a conversation. It's the place where community happens now.
Another listener question. A listener's curious to know if Wisconsin's current rail trails, including Elroy Sparta, could ever be expanded. Do you have your eyes on any trail expansions, especially in Wisconsin, in the works?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the most exciting evolutions of the trail movement, and really the evolution in the way that Rails to Trails Conservancy and our partners are work. We have gone from helping communities and states and otherwise develop individual trails, some of them really long, like Elroy Sparta. But because of the success of the movement in the last 50 years, we're now looking at connectivity. How do we connect these long trails to each other? How do we connect trails in more urban areas into networks that really allow people to move through these urban areas and get to get to places they want to go? And one of the great examples of that in Wisconsin is what we call the Route of the Badger. And Route of the Badger is one of our Trail Nation projects, a small suite of projects around the country that we are really trying to help prove this connectivity concept and show people how to do it and work with people on doing it. And Route of the Badger is in southeast Wisconsin. We're talking Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, Waukesha, where there's already 350 miles of amazing multi-use trail. And the goal of this project is to connect everything together into a 700-mile seamless network. And it's the number of nonprofit and public agency partners that have been working on this with us for years now is astounding. And the progress has been great. And when you look at a map of Wisconsin, there's a lot of metro areas where this connectivity work, is already in progress, but there's also such huge potential for connecting some of the long distance corridors. If you look at a trail map of Wisconsin, a multi-use trail map, it is not at all hard to see that there's a real opportunity to connect the lake, the lakefront in Milwaukee. It's almost all the way connected to Madison now. It's really, really close. And then from Madison, you can see that there's already some long distance trails, including the Elroy Sparta, that would eventually get you up to La Crosse. And think about a lake to river corridor from Milwaukee to La Crosse that would cross the entire state of Wisconsin. What an amazing amenity for the people in Wisconsin, but also what an amazing amenity for people all over the world would come and use something like that.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Eric Oberg, Midwest Regional Director for Rails to Trails Conservancy. He talked with us about the history of Rail to Trail in Wisconsin and the Elroy Sparta Trail, the first one in the nation. This conversation came from multiple audience questions as part of our Why Wisconsin project. Do you want to know something related to Wisconsin? Submit your question and we might tackle it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, private messages from the personalities and executives at Fox News seem to contradict some of the network's reporting on the 2020 presidential election. We'll get the latest details from a defamation lawsuit filed against the network. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.